right, Dieter and Hutch. We're talking about L.A., Lower Alabama All-Stars, Senior Bowl. We're no longer boycotting the Senior Bowl.
no.
The bad man is gone. He left some remnants, to be fair. Their roster is a goddamn travesty. But not in the players, in the actual physical roster to try to figure out who these guys are. But that's just me being annoyed, which I've been wanting to
do. As opposed to the norm.
Right. Let's go through some news and notes before we get into our guys, and I do think we'll keep this one rather tight because the Senior Bowl itself hasn't even been played. Not that I give too much of a damn about like the 11-on-11 aspect of it. I like the one-on-one stuff, but I know you're going to be all over it, and so we'll get your breakdown whenever that, in fact, goes down, and I'll probably get it before anyone on the show gets it. But,
sure.
Okay, two things to note. Matt Maiocco did a little journalism yesterday and got from 49-49 that they have in fact done three interviews for defensive coordinator.
Yep.
To the shock of no one, Gus Bradley was one. Then they also interviewed Joe Woods and who was the other? Oh, Raheem Morris was interviewed, which now we are definitely in a spot, Jake, where they are overtly waiting on Jim Schwartz to see if they can do something.
And I think the whole thing, and it's not that, like, they always try and keep stuff under wraps, but it is more than usual, I think. And I think the point is that, one, Kyle really values Raheem Morris and Gus Bradley and all those guys, and doesn't want to probably upset them and say, hey, we're going to take as long as it takes to get to Jim Schwartz, right? I think there's an element of that. So I think we're going to see where that situation is and try their darndest. But like that could take a minute. Like there's like, I wonder what happens there. If like they say we're going to set like a cutoff date and just hire Raheem Morris at this point, if we can't talk to Jim.
I'm just very curious on where the depth chart lies in house, because obviously they were all about Gus. They said that the net wasn't very wide, to paraphrase, but they bring in Raheem, which surprised me a little bit. Obviously, you do have to interview two minority candidates. You are not at a lack of possibilities there in the world of the NFL in 2026, which is a good thing. But like Raheem Morris coming in, I can't imagine that he was some sort of, with apologies to Joe Woods gets a lot of these interviews on those grounds, which is not fair to Joe Woods.
But I mean, yeah, he used to coach, for anyone, he used to coach like defensive backs and the secondary for the Niners before he took the Browns job and then didn't do very well.
Right. So he's kind of in the Art Shell mold of years past for defensive coaches. And then Raheem, like, you don't have to bring in Raheem, I guess, unless you're seriously considering him. I would hope that they're seriously considering him because he's a better option than Gus.
Yeah.
He's a better option.
He is. I don't think they would talk to Raheem if they weren't serious about. I think there's like a level of relationship that Kyle wouldn't bring him in if they weren't seriously considering him. I think he's, I don't know. It's interesting. It's like, what do they value? Do they value people that have like been in the building and know the language? And I think they tried to interview his former colleague in Atlanta for the secondary's job with, again, as Dieter found out, and then everyone sort of aggregated over the last sort of hours.
They could have plugged the show a little bit more in the aggregations.
They could have linked to Dieter and Hutch. That's all
just
you want.
Thought. Just
that's
thought.
All you want.
Just an idea.
But like once Bullocks is not on the coaching staff.
Right.
And they interviewed the Atlanta secondary's coach who worked with Raheem. There's an element of like due diligence of like talk to him and see what his experience is, maybe bring him in for Raheem. You could argue that. I think if I had to place a bet, I think if they don't get to talk to Jim, I think it will be Raheem. Mm. But again, that's like a 55-45 Raheem over Gus, because there is just an element of like, do they just want to be comfortable with Gus because he's just what they know? And
I guess comfortability is death in the modern NFL, and I think that operates on several levels. Yeah, I'll say this. There are clearly very strong Gus supporters in the building. And the way that they were talking about this going into an interview process, which was handled in a very clandestine manner, gave me the indication externally that they were just making sure that, you know, the table was clear to hire Gus. I can't say that that's no longer the case. I can't say that they're taking this seriously, but the fact that they have not hired Gus yet does provide an ounce of hope that they won't go that route. And having Raheem Morris interviewed and in the bag, though, again, Raheem can take a job somewhere else. I'm sure that he's a wanted commodity. There's some optimism that can be gleaned from very small amounts of information that they won't do what you and I both agree is the lazy thing to do. And I guess they've disproved some level of laziness, but definitely not the correct thing to do.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, they did what they said is they would cast a small net of candidates. And they clearly have a desire to talk to Schwartz, which is all fine. Yeah. I do think it would still behoove them to talk to some younger guys that are in assistant roles. That's sort of my general thing is like, this is as much as it is about, and in part, and I'm sure they're probably not doing that. Their argument would be, we have three serious candidates. We don't want to upset those candidates by talking to other people. I would argue you could inform those candidates, hey, we're going to like just talk to some other assistants just because we want to pick people's brains.
Yeah.
And I think they'd be smart enough to understand that. But again,
I'd also
like
to note on that, like two of those three are unemployed and the third one isn't getting job offers anywhere else.
Right.
Like I appreciate looking out for, you know, theoretically their feelings, but also it's a job hunt. Like you're not beholden to their feelings. You're beholden, in this case, to the shareholder, you know, not technically shareholders, right, but you're beholden to do the best. You have a fiduciary duty, if you will, to produce the best possible defensive coordinator for your team. And you can take into account familiarity and things like that in that process. But you have the responsibility to the fan base, to the players on your team, to absolutely give this thing its best shot. I'm encouraged that they've given it more of a shot than it seemed as if they would and what I heard they would. So that's a positive. But and the fact that, again, it's delayed gives some credence to the idea that they're waiting to see what happens with Jim Schwartz. And I guess they're in an unenviable position, because they cast such a narrow net. They're not in the position where they kind of have to get on with it. So that's just something
it is
we're
a lot of guys
on.
That like they should know where every single person they've interviewed is in the process. I mean, we'll see. I think it'll be really, they could easily be like, Jim is not coming. Like we can't even talk to him. The Browns are going to hold him to that contract. And that's the end of that. And then they make a decision. At the same time, I would think that they're going to try and push. And there's also an argument that like, hey, maybe they want to talk to the DB's coach for the Seahawks, who they also have to wait on.
It should also be noted that, you know, with the Rams and the Rams are done with the Seahawks and the Patriots. I don't know of that much going on with the Patriots staff, which is telling. No, but the Seahawks obviously are fixing to get poached when this thing is all said and done, as the 49ers well know that feeling. That brings, it's kind of like the transfer portal closing in college football. Like it brings some level of finality. And do you want to be left holding the bag? I'm not advocating expediency for the sake of getting ahead of it, but waiting on somebody that you probably know you're not going to hire just to have that conversation, while I appreciate the idea, probably, you know, in this case, I'll give Kyle some credit here, not worth the time, effort, energy, and the risk of then, you know, Raheem Morris getting a better offer from somewhere else, because I imagine that he's talking to many teams about many things all at one time. One other piece of NFL news to get to, Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, the Vikings GM, gets fired today. Ostensibly,
he came from the 49ers.
That's that was my question for you. Does he go? Does he come home? Does he come back here? Because he was here with Balke and Harbaugh, and then they kept him on when and promoted him, in fact.
And John Lynch is talked about him glowingly in almost every single draft presser.
Well, he's a Princeton guy. He's sharp as a tack. He is considered a really, really good mind. They've put together very, very good teams. They just made the wrong quarterback decision. My other question is, there's two options, I think, available to him. So it'd be a huge win for the Niners if they can bring him home and get him in-house, because that replaces a lot of the brain drain. He was the start of the brain drain for the 49ers. Does he go to the Chargers under Jim? They've had a lot of brain drain over the last year and a half or so. Does he take that a job there as a number two? Or, and here's my real galaxy brain idea, he's from New Jersey. He went to Princeton. Does he go and hang out with the Giants for a year so that when they do fire their GM, he just takes that job for Jim Harbaugh?
That's a great question. I like the galaxy brain idea. I think the reality would be you don't want to really stick around in the building and wait. And you don't really want to have the Sheehan stink rub off on you. I think you'd rather be in a more competent building. It would be interesting, though, if like, I think you'd bring him in with like a temporary name or role and just
advisor,
like, as an advisor, right? Yeah, special advisor until he figures out what he wants to do. Bring him in for a couple months for the draft, and then say, hey, like, we'll give you kind of whatever role you want, whatever weird title. It might upset some people that are trying to, you know, climb that trajectory. Even we don't really care. We'd love to have you in any role. I don't think that's out of the question at all.
There's not a single person that thinks that Joe Shane is keeping his job by next year. You know,
there's a lot of like GMs and it's whoever talks. I think what's the Bill Walsh quote? It's that, you know, coaches are too busy coaching the team and GMs are talking to the owner.
Yeah. They're having martinis with the owner talking about how
like,
to
it's
get
not
rid
the
of you.
Players. It's the coaching.
Yeah. He probably a pretty good politician with the Mara family. The other way that the Niners, and I have no indication on this whatsoever, this all just went down. There had been some rumblings for, I would say, the last 36 hours that this could go down because they all got summoned out to New Jersey where the Wolf's offices are, the owners of the Vikings. And a lot of people have made this sort of overarching vague suggestion, comment sections, stuff like this, that you bump John Lynch up to a different role and then you hire someone else to actually be the GM, as if John Lynch didn't do a very good job this year, as if they didn't make the playoffs with a roster that was, I mean, he Farhan'd the shit out of this thing. And that was good GMing. I don't quite understand how, you know, getting Mac Jones, he doesn't get any credit for that, you know, but whatever.
I think there were like a lot of limitations that Jed put on the roster, and the fact that they were like, we're going to be proactive about shipping off these contracts and clearing the slate and all that, which they still have to do a little bit of going forward. But yeah, I mean, I think he maneuvered. It's also, you could argue he actually didn't do that great of a job, but the coaching staff did. I would argue Keon White as an acquisition was like a monumental addition. I think they drafted overall fairly well.
Yes.
Some of the picks didn't hit, but a lot of that is like rookies just come in and get injured. And
that's the other aspect of this is, and I want to make sure that we have these ground rules sort of set. Like, if you hit on 50% of your draft picks, and you have to obviously have that a little bit top heavy, right? You need to hit on your top 100s or whatever. So Nick Martin is a serious demerit. But like, if you hit on those, if you hit on half of them, you won. Everyone talks, oh, the Seahawks draft so much better. The Rams draft so much better. Look at their drafts. Like, I'm not arguing they don't draft better. They have better players. But they don't hit at a higher rate than the Niners hit when the Niners hit well. The problem is the Niners hadn't hit well for many years. But these past 2 years, they've hit well, in my opinion. Now, it's still jury out on a lot of them.
Right.
But they've hit well in that you feel positive about a lot of the names if you just go down the list. And because it's not a, you know, they're not batting 1,000, like, they're on an absolute tear when it comes to drafting the past 2 years when you think about the hit rate. And again, this standard of, oh, well, these other teams draft better. Yeah, they have better players and they've done it more consistently. I'm not arguing that they're not better at drafting, but look at the hit rates. Look at some of the names that you don't know that are littered in there between, you know, in rounds 3, 4, and 5, and even round 2 in some cases, right, where it's like, okay. But it's because you don't live that every day, yeah, you don't feel it.
But Seattle's also built such a monster where all the pieces just fit what they do so well. Mm-hmm. And the Niners have a little bit of a mix and match thing where the picture isn't fully complete, and they were doubling down and wasted so many years kind of like swinging for the fences. And, you know, and the timeline got weird, especially with some older guys that they had to reset. I feel like you almost have to break it into two segments in terms of like which timeline they were on.
But like, let's just use the Seahawks 2024 draft just as an example, okay? Byron Murphy, 16th overall. That's a win. That's an easy win. Christian Haynes, 81 overall. Yeah, okay. Tyrese Knight.
He's been a useful player for
him. He's a depth player at 118. That's a good pick. A.J. Barner at 121 is a good pick. Nehemiah Pritchett at corner. Couldn't tell you.
I mean, this is round 5, though, we're talking about. And then it's like the rest are useless. Satoa Lamea, DJ James, Michael Jarrell, all pretty useless.
But if you hit the way that they hit on in 2023 with Witherspoon, Smith, and Jigba at 5 and 20, Derek Hall, who I think is a really good player, at 37, and then Charbonnet at 52, it doesn't matter that you drafted like absolute shit from round 4 on.
Anthony Bradford, who's terrible, has still been a starter for them.
Right. So, again, I'm not arguing that they haven't done better, but if we're just talking hit rate, because they go, they got like 40.
Did you know they drafted Bo Melton in 2022?
I did know they drafted Bo Melton. I love Bo Melton.
It's interesting, though. The Niners have this ability to like pick up useful players in late rounds, and the Seahawks are really bad at that. The Seahawks are great at hitting on like sort of premium talent early, which is how you should grade it. But like in the late rounds, it feels like they sort of lose their sense of what they're even looking for.
I mean, late round 2024 for the Rams, Brennan Jackson, Tyler Davis, Cardi, who they've already cut, Whittingham, who I think is actually a pretty good player. Whittingham is a role player. Bo Limmer, who they tried, and then they said, no more, we're not doing that. KT Leviston. Again, they have Steve Avila as their second round pick, their first pick in 2023. Yeah. Like, they've made really good picks. They also took Stenson Bennett, 128, which there's something else going on there. I don't want to get into it. But, like, the idea that you have to hit at some point higher than, like, 45, 50%, I just think is...
Yeah, I mean, I think people are right to be frustrated with the way they built the roster the last few years, and also injuries derail it, where trying to realize the vision of, like, what they were looking for.
Yeah.
People also forget, like, how good it was looking, you know, at certain points in the season, and then by the end, all the guys are hurt. And so you go, well, it's not a successful draft class. It's also, you can't grade a draft class on 1 year. Should we talk about this year's draft class and the Senior Bowl?
I just want to point out that I would say that the Niners hit on 4 of their first 5 picks in this past year's draft, in Williams, Collins, Stout, and West. I feel bullish about all of them.
I agree. Collins is injury and development but he's like clearly played a key role and will be at least at worst like a rotational defensive tackle for him.
Yeah, he'll give you 15 snaps a game for a long time. I think that he can end up being a 30, 35, 40 guy, but you're getting a nice baseline just because he's so goddamn big.
Agreed.
Let's talk about some dudes at the Senior Bowl. And let's start with your guys, Jake. I think your list, frankly, is a little bit better. I have the winners. I have the two winners, but I like your list better. So let's start with, and again, no particular order, Gabe Jackus out of Illinois.
Let's say Jackus.
Let's go with Jackus. It's cooler sounding.
So he's interesting. I just think outstanding frame, like real power at the point of attack. There's like a question about like the depth of his bag and, you know, is he a fully well-rounded edge rusher? I don't know, but like in terms of you're trying to pick something to hold on to, and for me, that's a guy with truly, truly elite frame, and I think he's going to test extremely well.
Yeah,
I think he's going to. I just think like when you're looking at all these random players and you're trying to pick up on something, I want to see edge rushers that have the right frame, that have power, that have speed, and have like measurable athleticism. And he popped off the tape for me.
This guy is a classic 5 technique and a fun one because he doesn't have that sort of wide 9, true 7 bag that you're looking for. And yet you put him out there and all he did was win his reps and win him with distinction and ease. 6'3", 260. I think he's going to test great too. It's a heavy 260, if that makes sense. Like, yeah, he's a sturdy boy. This is just somebody that, again, we're not talking. I just think he's a winner.
It's not quite the same as Olufemi Oladejo last year, but there, no. I think Oladejo had a little bit more to his game, but there is like an element of like untapped athleticism and a lot of upside that I think is only going to go up.
I found him to be very twitchy for having a big old butt.
Agreed.
Which is something I'm really into. I mean, let's just be clear about this. I'm a butt man through and through. All right, I want to just stay on your list. I just want to go bang, yep, bang, bang down your list. Kyle Lewis out of Pitt. I have an idea for Kyle Lewis. Tell me your idea for Kyle Lewis.
I'm not sure he's a true linebacker. He's a little small. He's like 5'11"-ish, and he's like 220-something. He feels like a slot or like a box safety. I don't think he has the frame to play linebacker, but my God, the coverage instincts are unbelievable. He's just super slippery. I think he's kind of a Swiss Army player that you can put in a lot of different roles and is going to help you out. But in terms of being like a Mike or a Will, I don't necessarily see it, but I just love the feel, the bend, the coverage instincts, and the way he gets his hand on every play. I think he's a real, real intelligent player, yep, who has sort of unteachable feel that I don't necessarily think is a linebacker.
2024 first team All-American. You probably didn't know that. First team All-American in 2024. He had 201 tackles, 25 and a half for loss, 10 sacks, 6 interceptions, 12 pass breakups, and 2 forced fumbles. He is on Bruce Feldman's freak list. He goes 21 miles per hour plus. Yeah, he's 6 foot and 225. There has never been a better time to be Kyle Lewis and play in the NFL than right now. Because of his namesake, Kyle Hamilton, Nicky Manwari. Yeah, those guys are bigger and stronger, but the position that I like to talk about a lot, and it's obviously very prevalent in the college level, star, jackal, joker, whatever you want to call it, with defensive coordinators, if they're on their P's and Q's, looking for more guys like this, big nickel would be another way to maybe describe it. If defensive coordinators want to adapt the game to where it needs to be and what Mike McDonald's going to do, and what's the one thing we know about every Super Bowl? Every coach watches it. Every coach copies it. Whatever happens in the Super Bowl, you're going to see in places that they shouldn't be trying all across the NFL next year. And people are going to watch Emanwari, and they're going to watch Witherspoon sliding in, and they're going to go, oh, we should try that, as if it's a brand new novel idea that hasn't been happening since 2023 and even beyond that in the NFL.
Turns out you need elite coaching and elite athletic talent to
what a concept. This guy's an elite athlete. This guy doesn't have the frame. All he does is win. And maybe the better comp, if it's difficult to kind of put him in that Hamilton Emanwari thing because he doesn't have the crazy long arms, right, he doesn't have the frame. How about like a Buda Baker type where put him in the box, he's undersized. How about a Honey Badger type back in the LSU days, early Honey Badger?
And Smile Mundon was a linebacker we liked.
I love
Smile sort of
Mundon.
Like this. I think he's a backup for the Eagles, but he was sort of like a weird player where he just looked awesome in the slot as more of like a quasi safety player. And he was bigger than this.
Yeah.
But he's talking about players who can play a lot of different roles for you and have fluidity and coverage. And there's just something to him that you're like, you're going to find a spot for him. And unlike, remember when you were doing the Isaiah Simmons thing of, is he a safety? Is he a linebacker? He was stiff. Like, he was big. And so it was like fun, but it was like, no, he couldn't cover or really do the things you needed at either position in the modern NFL. This is more of a flexible player.
And that, I'm really happy you brought up Isaiah Simmons, because I was just thinking about him a couple of days ago. And what he should have been, obviously we're in a very different era of NFL defenses, but he should have been a 3-4 outside linebacker in kind of the Terrell Suggs mold.
Yep.
The problem was he was too stiff to play that. He didn't have enough bend. And that should have been the red flag that said, no. I covered the Warriors back when Draymond first got in the starting lineup. And I'm a Draymond apologist in many ways. I won't apologize for that. But Draymond, amongst so many things, and I've talked to Steve Kerr about this a million times over, a lot of things were happening with the Spurs and the Heat before that and positionless basketball. But the term tweener was a real kiss of death in the right. NBA up until the mid-teens. And Draymond Green turned that into, frankly, an archetype for success moving forward. I'm not saying we're nearly there yet, and I'm not saying it will happen, but it does feel as if nine-year-old Dieter's idea of building the whole team out of safeties is closer than it's ever been.
You don't know that an archetype exists until someone proves it to you. You go, well, he doesn't fit into the archetypes we know,
right?
So he's nothing. He's in between right. these things rather than it being its own entity, which I think is a pretty like understandable way humans, you know, view archetypes and view things that we understand and we don't know, because instinctively you go, well, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
Like that can't work because it's new and different. And
but isn't that exactly
that
what
fits.
You want? Isn't that, don't you want something new? And how do you game plan for something that you don't quite understand?
I agree. But I think there is, despite a lot of like very intelligent, crafty, innovative coaches, there is still a lot of institutional belief in what works and what doesn't.
True.
And until someone like a Mike McDonald or like a Ben Johnson, who aren't from these like deep families of coaching trees, mm-hmm. who kind of don't give a shit, prove something right. to you, you kind of aren't sure that it's going to exist. And and I think that's where we reject some of the stubbornness the 49ers have had in years past, especially going forward.
Just devil's advocate real fast.
Yep.
How do you game plan for it? Well, also how do you coach it? And especially yep. guys who have a lot of institutional knowledge, which the Niners very much value, becomes a bit of a problem. You get very set yep. in your ways. You get more conservative as you get older, I hear. But I think that applies to many, many things beyond right. just the baseline politics. Let's talk about someone we actually talked a good deal about last year, Jake. And yep. you get to pronounce his name.
Davison Igbinosin, Ohio you. State. If you are not subscribed to the Hutch Report, I did my first episode of, I want to keep on to call it Behind the Iron Curtain. Behind the Curtain.
At this point, you should just call it that, and I can just call cringe it
Behind
every time
the
you
Iron
do.
Curtain. Yeah. So it's essentially what I'm doing is you're sitting down with me as I watch tape.
Yeah.
So
it's great.
It's just sort of first look, what my feel of a player is, what I'm looking for. And again, sometimes I'm going to go, oh, I'm not sure. And then you wait until you see a pattern. With Igbinosin, he's really interesting because he has almost the perfect frame and athleticism to be an elite corner, like just sort of an ideal build, maybe a little light, a little thin. I think that's a concern. I yes. hated how he played the run game against Michigan. He looked at sometimes like he did not want to be involved. And I typically don't like that. There's a Sauce Gardner-y element. I think he is a little bit more physical than Sauce Gardner, which is a pretty low bar. Because Sauce Gardner's just a string bean who doesn't care about tackling at all. I think he actually does have decent tackling form, but he gets washed out and gets attacked. As a corner, though, he has an ability to shadow routes and run the routes for wide receivers in a way I don't see from a lot of other people in this draft. When he gets beat initially, he has the long speed to catch up. He has the length. I think what annoys me about him is he does the hard stuff really well, and then the easy stuff, like he'll get handsy and just be overly handsy and like draw a flag or do something stupid where you're like, I don't know what you're thinking there. He also has a tendency to have this like false step where things in front of him, I think he's a little bit worse. Like going deep, covering deeper routes, I think he's much more natural, which again, I think are harder to cover, but things where it's like a hitch or a quick outbreaker, which are the more common routes you're going to face more of the time.
Of course.
He has this like false step at times where instead of just driving on it, there's like a split second where he goes back another step that I worry about. And so for him, I think there's a world where he is truly a top five corner in the league in 3 years. I really think he has the athletic capabilities, some of the things he's flashed on tape. I think there's also a world where he is he's not able to play special teams because of that size, and he just doesn't figure it out. And so you've got like a Jeff Okuda situation where he's kind of useless in 3 years.
My.
I think there's a wide range of outcomes for him. That said, really impressed me in some of these Senior Bowl reps. I think the ball tracking can be a little shaky, but his length allows him to play through it well. He's a really, really interesting prospect, and I kind of don't blame anyone for any take they have on him because there's such a wide range of outcomes.
Yeah, he's definitely a Rorschach test of a player. I think what we talked about him a lot last year, and we thought he was kind of a third-round guy. Is he still a third-round guy? Because the way that you describe him, that's probably a third-round guy, but because of the upside, he's not. Like, that's kind of where I lie on him.
He is, to me, right now, I feel like I would feel comfortable drafting him in the third round. I think, realistically, he gets pushed to round two in terms of all the measurables, the fact that he does communicate at a high level. He had to play a lot of cover four, a lot of cover six, a lot of communication involved in that.
Ohio State runs pro style defense. They actually jam on the line.
I think he goes round two.
I so appreciate them.
I think he goes round two, and you go, this could be a total whiff. Even though there's so much to like. And again, overall, I really like the player, but there's a lot of downside and like that false stepping thing. I'm not sure if that's fixable or not. I'm not sure.
It could be done in 20 minutes or it could take his entire life. There's some Renardo Green here. There's some real Renardo Green energy to this guy.
But I like him. I like him a lot. And I think he showed well at the Senior Bowl.
I think so.
I'm going to rip through my last two guys.
Yeah. I was surprised that Bo Stevens made your list, to be honest. I didn't have him as any, you know, demerits or anything. He just didn't stand out to me. What did you like about Bo Stevens?
Bo Stevens, so first rep, he gets destroyed by Daryl Taylor from Florida State and then immediately goes, come back, come back. He's like, I tripped or something. I wasn't ready for that.
He and got absolutely, I mean, no one got beat harder than that first rep.
Yeah, and then the next rep, he dirted him. He put Daryl Taylor into the dirt, and then he did the same thing in a one-on-one against, I want to say it was the Texas A&M kid or Texas Tech. Yeah. Did the same thing.
Oh yeah, the big Hunter 10, the tackle.
So it was, I see him pop off the ball. There's one guy on Twitter who has been, I think of Rico, Spider Rico, who has been incessantly sending me Bo Stevens clips. I watched a lot of Iowa last night. He flies off the ball and can really move and drive in the way someone like a team like the 49ers loves. There is sometimes where he gets stood up straight and that worries you a little bit. But I don't think he is a horrendous anchor. I think anyone from Iowa you can draft in the third round and feel good about. I think he has the lower half drive, the athleticism to really move people in the run game and get out in space and do damage. I think the pass game will be another question, but I think he really works well with other people in a unit. And I think, you know, some people might mock him as like a day three guy. I think realistically he could go in round three and you'd feel good about that because I think he will test incredibly well. And I think in the run game is just phenomenal.
I thought Durant got him a couple of times just going through my notes here in this one. Again, he'll give up a little, but he does hold it. It's not like he's consistently getting driven back. That's a positive. And you're talking about him as a center specifically?
Guard.
Okay.
Left guard.
Okay.
There's the other Iowa guy, Caleb Jones, I think, right? Who's the center.
Yes, that's right. If I had a clearer roster, that would be a lot easier to tell you.
You can't go with Iowa. You're like, are they all the same guy?
They got a Green Bay Packers to them.
Jennings Dunker, I don't know about him as a tackle. We can talk about him in a bit.
Jennings Dunker is going to be a name that's talked about a lot because I think he's getting a lot of first round love. I think we just talk about him now. I think he's a specimen of a man. I mean, first off, let's just talk about offensive line aesthetics. Glorious. He's got it. I love how low he gets. I think that he looks like a guard and you can bump him out. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm giving Spencer Burford too much credit. Maybe this is why he's about to get $10, $12 million. But like, I was kind of radicalized by the idea of Spencer Burford, career guard, getting bumped out to tackle, and then you see him in training camp. And I know a lot of people didn't see this. I saw it. I was keeping close eyes on him the whole time.
He moved.
Oh, my God. I was taken aback. And there were some plays where I'm like, is that Trent? Oh, no, it's Spencer Burford. Of course, it's not Trent. Trent doesn't practice. But Dunker is not that guy, but I love the idea of putting him and his prodigious gut in the middle, and then again in a pinch, bumping him outside. I think
he's a guy that is going to be a useful offensive lineman immediately. I don't actually know that he has high level upside. I think
he can't play left. He can't play left tackle.
I don't think he's stiff. To me, he's Austin Pleasance at tackle. Like he feels stiff and physical, but like it doesn't move well enough and sometimes doesn't drive well enough, but like is glorious. And I cannot quit the aesthetic and I cannot quit the sort of physicality and all that.
6'4", 320. I don't have arm measurements. I would imagine that they're bog standard kind of.
He feels like a big guard. He feels like a big physical guard for me.
He really does have some. Who would be my comp for him? Is it wrong to say like a Landon Dickerson-ness to him? Something like that?
I think Dickerson's a little smaller.
Yeah.
But
he gets so low. Like, that's the thing. Like, he was in. There's a lot of offensive linemen that are very vertical and upwards. Yep. They don't want to move their lower back. He's in like a sumo stance.
Yeah.
On
it's
every
like Trey Zun for Texas A&M, who, again, I think is a center. He's like low as hell. And he stands up straight and you're like, oh, you're not that short.
No, you're like 6'2", 6'3". Yeah. You're a pretty big guy, but you understand that low man wins. And you're probably not, you know, you don't have the nimblest feet and you're not the strongest. So how are you going to win?
Right.
Angles and getting under somebody's a good angle.
I like Dunker. I am much lower on him than I think most people will be based on aesthetic and vibes and pure gloriousness of his energy. Last guy I'll talk about.
Yeah.
We talked about disruptors at defensive tackle. And in terms of like, I don't want to get out over my skis here, but early, maybe the closest thing to Walter Nolan upside-wise might be Caleb Banks. It's a different beast, but the disruption, the high-level potential for disruption,
I think
Nolan is a different specimen. He's a tier above, but Banks is a fucking freak in the best way.
335 pounds, absolute explosion off the line. You know who my comp was?
I think I know where you're going to go, but say it.
DeForest Buckner. Where'd you think I was going?
I thought you were going to go to, played for the Cardinals last year. Enormous.
Oh, my God.
40 years old.
Yeah, that would be, I won't even say it. It's blasphemy.
I know.
No, he's not that guy. This is a gap splitter at a huge size with, I wish he had longer arms, frankly, but they're long enough. I mean, he is.
Yeah.
He wins the way that smaller guys win with the size to also hold up that way. And when you get into a lot of these pre-draft, postseason, situations, you end up with a lot of kind of one-trick ponies, like Hunter for Texas Tech, the number 10, the defensive tackle. Like, you know what he is. You get these little gleans of positivity, like, oh, he looked pretty good in pass rush because you know he can stop the run. Or you get these guys who are, 2 inches too short and 30 pounds too light, but they explode off the edge and they win in a lot of one-on-ones. And so people get excited about that. But then you actually have to put them on an NFL field and it's like, there is levels to this. This guy has the frame and to show the level of pop and slitheriness off the line without being like, crazy, super twitchy to where you're talking, top 10 pick, because if he had that, he'd be a top 10 pick with his frame.
Yeah.
But he looks like a real diamond in the rough. And I think it's pretty polished actually.
The high level upside is game wrecking. Truly a guy who you have to double team and freeze up everything around him. Again, I got to watch more on him, but just from the Senior Bowl and just in terms of like the holy shitness of it all.
And let's be very clear about Caleb Banks here, because I imagine he's someone we're going to be talking about a tremendous amount moving forward. This is a first round player. He might not get drafted in the first round, but he's going to get a I have a hard time, and we'll get into this Florida tape in earnest here. We've been mostly offensive line lately. Like, I have a hard time imagining that he's not going to get a first-round grade from us with our love of projectables, our love of guys who can do it all, our size, just the mere size of them gets people excited. I think right now Mock Draft Database, which at this point I'm using as sort of the consensus, they have him at 29. There's going to be a lot of teams.
As Kawachipto mentions, he's coming off an injury, has a worrisome injury history. That's another reason might be, you know, round two guys are sometimes round one with injury worries, that sort of thing. There's a world where he's a round two guy, definitely. But man, like if you want to say...
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying what a goddamn steal that would be.
And honestly, you could go and be like, well, Javon Kinlaw was... the tough thing about Kinlaw is like his whole thing was like he actually fired off the line and was super disruptive. And once he had that knee surgery, he was gone forever. And then he kept needing more and more and more knee surgeries. And so he could never have that. So he had to become a different player.
Be fair, there's some concern here because Banks at Florida from, I really dislike the University of Florida on a personal level.
I agree.
But if I recall correctly, he was a little bit too finesse, not powerful enough, not just taking on blocks, shedding dudes. He was always looking for that pop. He was also poorly coached at the University of Florida. I can very confidently say that, understanding who was on that staff and the attrition that the staff had from Billy Napier's first year. So there's going to be concern about, okay, we are in somewhat of a Kinlaw situation where it's this huge dude who doesn't play huge. I didn't get a single Kinlaw vibe off of him watching him. And I guess the tape will be the real judge of that. It's going to be really tough on that tape, though, because the level of quit in that Florida team got very high very late. And I also believe that's when their schedule got even harder. So we might be watching a lot of USF Florida tape when it was the last bastions of glory. Let's go to my list.
One more thing I want to mention before we get into Dieter's guys. The salary cap projections are in, and OTC had him at 295.5 as an estimate. 295.5 million. That number has gone up. 301 to 305. So each team is probably getting, compared to what we have been estimating, another 6 to 10 million in cap spaces here.
Who wants to go buy a defensive tackle that will never actually pan out? Because if I got some extra cash for you,
we can do the Timofey Mozgov prediction
Mozgov. We have to,
Mozgov of the year award.
Mozgov of the year. Okay, let's go to my list. Your list I felt was much stronger. My list is very high end and ironically bottom heavy. Cage Casey, offensive line out of Boise State. This was a man who was done dirty, frankly, by the coaching staff at the senior.
Agreed.
Bowl. I'm not implying that they're not good coaches. And I have no frame of reference here. I'm not immobile. He was at center on day one and looked awesome. He looked really good. Kept winning reps, kept beating guys who are, you know, day one, day two talents at defensive tackle. And you're like, who is this guy? I thought he played for Memphis for a while because of the helmet. Turns out it's just a fancy Boise State helmet, that. And I'm like, whoever this guy is, Casey, I'm in on him. Then day two, they're like, try out tackle. Nope.
He's like, oh, shit.
That's not for me. Now, he did play tackle. And ironically, I went through my notes, Jake. He's one of the first players I sent you this season that I loved Cage Casey and that there was really something about him. My notes are so scatterbrained that I just, find Cage Casey somewhere on my hard drive or in my iCloud. I loved Cage Casey, and I liked him at tackle, at least early in the season for Boise. Watching the one-on-ones, I can no longer stand by that, though we will watch more tape on the guy. But I think at center, he's really got something there and looked really good in that spot, looked comfortable, looked like that was his natural position as opposed to tackle. Cage Casey's a guy that I'm just going to be keeping my eye on for the next couple of weeks because there's There's something there, and he looks like a good scheme fit for the Niners. But frankly, I have a hard time believing that he wouldn't be a good fit for anybody, given that he can play.
He seems, again, like a guy that can kind of play on a lot of different spots. Probably not tackle unless you're in a pinch, but I'm with you. I liked him a lot on the interior.
I mean, Grant Barton, the center for the Buccaneers. Yep. He's not Grant Barton. He's not.
I would say, I mentioned earlier, Trey Zune, and we'll talk about Texas A&M in a second. But
boy, will we. I want to give this name out again. I don't think it technically applies for the Niners. We are very much in an open-minded whole NFL portion here. We'll narrow it down on Niners plenty. But Tanner Koziol, thank you, is awesome. He's sick. It took one rep for me to write down his name five times. The next seven reps that I saw of him, I'm like, this is the dude. He has some sweet, sweet mitts. He is 6 foot six, 6 foot seven, 250 pounds. He's not the fastest dude in the world, but he wins his routes. He is a deft route runner. And I'm just going to pull this up. Hopefully this is not the end of our copywriting situation. Look at this man just dunking on people. Oh, you'll get other angles. Don't worry.
He can get up.
Ball State, so he had to block a little bit because he was in the MAC. Linebackers can't stick with him. Safeties can't go up with him. And he's got, I would argue, maybe the best hands of anybody I saw this week at the Senior Bowl. So Tanner Koziol, whatever you want to say, I think has worked his way up a very, very Spartan tight ends list. And
the tight ends are interesting. The tight ends are really interesting. There's a wide variety this year, which, you know, maybe they'll work out. Maybe they won't. I don't think there's the premium talent like last year had.
There's one.
But it might be deeper. Well, yeah, I mean, no, there's obviously Sadiq and then the rest.
Yeah, but there's a lot of guys in that late second, third, fourth round range, that sort of 60 to 115. If I had to put a ballpark on it, a really weird, strange ballpark that I just threw out there. Let's call it 50 to 150. There's like 12 to 15 tight ends that can get drafted. Right. And frankly, between now and the draft, you could just flip them. You can mix and match. It really feels like there's
no
a lot of the
I have no faith that
same.
The Niners will select a useful one. their process at tight end since George Kittle has been astoundingly poor, aside from Charlie Warner, who is a useful player.
What about Cam Latu, current fullback and special teams ace of the...
Once again, I will mention Cam Latu was the only player in his draft class, and I looked at a lot of tight ends. He was the only one in red that I said, no. I said, fuck no. Yeah. There's nothing to hold on to. There's no explosion. There's no blocking. Like, he didn't have the physical upside. He didn't have the production. He was just like a large target in the red zone. The 49ers went, we love all the nothing he can do. Let's take him in the third round.
He went to Alabama. He must be good.
He was a late day three guy. And they were like, we got to get him round three.
Well, they nailed it once. And they're like, oh, our process is undefeated. And it's like, no, it's actually.
He didn't test well at all. He was incredibly mediocre.
Okay. Before you blow a gasket, Cam Latu, we've gone over it a million times. Let's talk about Chandler Rivers. Chandler Rivers is like the opposite of, again, pronounce Ohio State guy's name.
Davison Igbinosun.
Doesn't have the frame. But my God, is he a scrapper. Like Igbinosun, right? Igbinosun. Thank you. I'll get it right. He's a mirror. He just stays with you. He's 5'10". He's got some weight to him, but he's 5'10". It's going to be an issue for a lot of teams. I don't think it should be. I think this guy is, at the very minimum, an exceptional slot. And because he was good for 50 tackles a year, he loves the point of attack, and I thought that he was just in the hip pocket of every receiver he went up against at the Senior Bowl. You watch a little bit of Duke, and this is preceding a question I think we're going to take in just a bit. Duke gets men. Duke plays like grown man football. And this guy, again, the measurables aren't great, but the tape as far as I can tell, and again, we'll get more into it
here, yeah, Duke gets like two or three stars that are just like annoying little shits who fight for their lives.
I sent a lot of kids to Duke back in the day on this predication of guys who were smart, guys who were good enough to play at the time Power 5 football, but guys who probably needed a year or two of coaching. And when I was in South Florida, I mean, in part of ranking every kid in South Florida, I ended up doing a lot of mentoring of 17, 18-year-old guys in South Florida in trying to get them to the right spot and connecting them with the right coaches. Was it journalism? It was the right thing to do. And I put three or four kids at Duke, two of which went to the league, because, hey, you're getting offers from lower-end schools, Sunbelt schools, MAC schools. You're getting kind of that. P.J. Fleck at Western Michigan was on me all the time about the guys that I'm like, you should go to Duke if they're offering you, because they would pull from the same pool. But I said, okay, let's be real here. You're a two. I have you as a three-star. Everyone else has you as a one or a two-star. I think you're better than they're saying. But let's be real about the situation. The likelihood that you're going to go play pro, given your pedigree currently,
right,
is not in your favor. So what are you going to get out of this thing? And in the NIL era, that's a different conversation. But in the time then, when these guys are not getting bags under the table, like the four and the five stars, and they're just having to pick a school, it's like, go to the best school. And what are you going to be better suited for? Apologies to PJ Fleck. He did not like this when I told him. And it's like, but apologies. Like, he's like, well, I can coach him. I can get him to the league. And it's like, yes, but you can't. And your track record kind of proves it. You going to be better off with a degree from Duke, or are you going to be better off with a degree from Western Michigan? And as someone with a degree from the University of Missouri, let me tell you, wish I had the Duke one. Wish I had the Duke one. Not that I could have gotten in, but it's merely it's merely that Duke does a very good job. They have a long track record now under many coaches. Back then it was Cutcliffe, of finding guys who can play at that level, need a little bit of seasoning, but are smart enough to take the coaching and have enough talent to maximize whatever that is. They get a lot of dudes who maximize what they are, and that's a hell of a lot better to me in a lot of situations, particularly when we're talking about day three draft picks, than guys who have all this talent in the world but have never put it together once in their lives. At some point, that characteristic is the truth. And I'd rather have some overachievers with something to offer. And Duke usually gets those guys going all the way back to 2012, 2013, 2014. So I always like one Duke guy. Chandler Rivers is my one Duke guy this year because I know the kind of program he's coming from. Let's talk about our favorite player, bar none, at the Senior Bowl, Jake. I'm just going to give you he's on my list. He's on anyone's list who watched. I literally have 20 screen grabs on my desktop right now of coaches just in awe of Demetrius.
Crown over. I mean,
Demetrius Crown over. Wow.
What a fucking specimen. I mean, this dude is phenomenal. And sometimes when you see an enormous tackle, and let's be clear, tallest guy at the senior, biggest guy at the Senior Bowl.
Yeah.
He's huge. Like,
he made very large defensive ends look puny.
When you see a guy like this and you go, okay, everyone gets excited about the really large tackle.
Yeah.
There was a rep where I forget who it was, but he tried to power through him. And it just as an example, it literally went like this.
Nowhere.
He went nowhere, which doesn't happen in these. There's always like a slide.
Yep.
The offensive tackle is to, hop his feet and set and slide. He didn't move. He just ate it. And when you watch him, and I went back and I watched all of Texas A&M, which has like four very draftable guys.
Yes.
All quite different. All like a
former kind of Duke head coach, Mike Elko, by the way.
A lot of different variety at Texas A&M. Clearly like invested in that offensive line of four draftable guys, three of them in the first three rounds, and one of them on day three. Like, Crownover is enormous, but also plays a little bit lighter than his enormous size. So is this going to be an outside zone guy? Probably not, But my God, the pass, and so he's susceptible to inside moves. He's going to be susceptible to like ghost moves and speedy, bendy guys. Mm-hmm. But no one's beating him with power
at all. Not a single one. Not a single one.
And because of his length, like he can really reach and get a hand on some of those guys, even if they are beating him initially. But like his pass protection, when you watch reps, anyone that he can get even a finger on is not getting around it. At Texas A&M. And when they use a lot of him just in like sort of gap scheme or power runs, a lot of like, he's not pulling, he's just on an angle like at Texas A&M. He's not doing any pulling. He's not doing a ton in space, but like he can get involved.
You don't want that thing moving forward. You don't want 6'7", 335 pounds with 35 inch arms with momentum.
There's a lot to be concerned about, but there's so much more to be excited about. And I think he could be a little bit like DeJuan Jones, but much lighter. Like DeJuan Jones is like 400 something pounds. He weighed in at 330 something. It's hard not to like him.
I loved his footwork for a big man. He is not fleet of foot, but I loved his footwork. His hand usage could really use some refinement. It's raw there. It also doesn't really need to be anything more than raw. Like, I think 80% of NFL defensive ends aren't doing anything once he gets the mitt on you. He is he's a wall, and he can move his feet enough to keep the wall in front of you. He will, as you said, swim moves might be there. Guys who get up and under him, though I thought he kept a pretty good pad level for a huge man. Not great. You know, it's going to be an issue. But I'm comfortable saying that of any non-first round graded offensive tackle, he has the highest ceiling. And I don't know where that falls currently. I would have a very difficult time trying to convince somebody after pick 50 that you should wait on him. Because I think as it stands now, he is not in the cycle. He's not a buzzy name. I loved the tape. I loved it. I don't need to go over with offensive tackles, and this is an issue with the NFL, I would argue, in the whole, but I'm gonna be susceptible to it right now. I don't need to know what you can't do. I need to know what you can do, and we can work with that from this point on. You could play him at guard tomorrow.
I disagree with that. I think he's, like, enormous, and, I mean, It depends what system you're running, but like, I don't know if you have a shorter quarterback playing an enormous guy at guard is going to be a little bit of an issue.
I'll give you that.
But I know what you're saying.
Like, what are you're not getting around him. The level of stunts.
But like that could congest some of the space and some of the stuff that you want to run with a guard where you want to move some of your guards. I think he is a true tackle. But like in terms of like, if you are running a scheme that's throwing the ball a lot and spreading it out, like you could play him at guard.
I just don't see how you can't do a Mekhi Becton situation with him as it stands. And, he's 6'7", 364. I mean, I see a lot of Becton in him, but I like the footwork enough to where I have no problem. Left tackle is going to be a bit of an issue when you get out to those wide nines and the real wide splits.
Yep.
But at right tackle, day one, I think you're in a really comfortable spot with him because it's pretty, you know, I obviously, right tackle and you can mix and match your guys. But typically that's a tighter split off of the right tackle. And with so many teams going to the odd man front, I just think that you're in a lot of head on hat situations. He just doesn't lose. And I was very taken aback by how good he looked at the Senior Bowl. And then you watch the film, and I only got through the Notre Dame one. I thought he was outstanding in
he's
that
awesome.
Notre Dame game.
He's and awesome. He's awesome.
Real pop as well. Zion Young out of Mizzou really needs very little analysis. Man amongst boys.
Yep. I mean, it's funny. He actually lost to probably my least favorite tackle. And day two, Austin Barber out of Florida, who I just think is a soft-handed, like, I do not like his tape at all. He was better day two, and Young lost once to him, which you know because he's winning like every other rep, and he can just go through people.
To be clear, he's not just winning. He is like Euro stepping dudes. He's spinning them. He is toying with them. And then also when they're like, hey, can you not do the fancy stuff? He's like, oh, okay, bet. And then he just plows you into the ground, even though he's giving up 50 pounds in all likelihood. He's 6'5", 262.
Yep.
He's a freak. He's an absolute freak. Here's the issue with Zion Young, as someone who witnessed every Zion Young game firsthand. Well, not firsthand, but watched every Zion Young game this year and talked a lot to a lot of people, friends and professional acquaintances alike, about Zion Young. If his head is in it, he's one of the 10 best players in this class. His head's not always in it. And it's not to say that he's, you know, he's a total wild card or whatever. He's an emotional player. He was good for 15 every game for doing something just dumb and emotional. I think he's a smart guy. The engine runs too hot often, and then you have to shut the entire car down to get the radiator to cool off. And there would be reps where you would see this and you'd be like, hey, Zion, you know, I don't know, maybe we temper it out a little bit to where you're not, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to take over this entire series, which he did once every 2 weeks. He'd be like, you know what, we're done here. And he would go and he'd get 2 sacks and he'd 4 pressures and it'd be done. And you know, you get in the red zone and it's over. And then there would also be series where you're like, I don't know, Zion, like maybe we don't play patty cake for the next couple plays. Maybe just get off the field.
Inconsistent just generally.
He's a sports car. I you can't take the kids to school in the sports car. But man, if you got a nice Saturday and you got some windy roads, no one's having a more fun time than the guy in the sports car. He is a first round talent with a third round temperament, and I think that he goes bottom round one.
Yeah, I don't think he makes it out of round one, but that makes sense. That makes sense to me. I mean,
he'd be and to pull it back to Niners, he'd be an unbelievable win for the Niners. Yeah. I know that people would say it's a redundancy because you already have Mikel, you already have Bosa.
This is a get blue chip players any way you can draft. Doesn't matter where they are.
In 2 years, you're going to be talking about, hey, how can we get off of Bosa because we have Zion Young coming in? I mean, if it works out. And then on the other side is, well, that was really bad, and well, Kyle's out of a job anyway. So, it's not crazy risk because it's not off the field stuff as far as I know. It's not, he's just a temperamental football player.
Do you remember a temperamental football player who played for Mizzou last year, who had some pretty big plays in the playoffs for the Chicago Bears?
I do. This is another thing that I'll just say flat out. I don't think that Eli Drinkwitz is actually a very good coach. And I think that's going to be a real problem for my Tigers moving forward. I think he is an exceptional recruiter. I think that he is a great talent evaluator of coaches. So if you believe in the Bill Cowher school of I don't coach players, I coach coaches, he's very, very good at that. I think that he's a great CEO to the point where they don't have a GM. He's the GM of their team.
Right.
But if we're talking about, you know, the Cignettis of the world or the Alex Golishes of the world, guys who can get down and dirty and get players to maximize their potential through technique and scheme and the interpersonal relationships that are necessary in all of coaching, he's not actually that good at that.
Right.
But he can get you to come.
He wants to take a mace to your face, and you're talking about a guy who's like, you know, got thrown a spear from a distance because it looks kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, Drinkwitz is thinking about bits and how to keep Mizzou nationally relevant.
Right.
And he is a great coach to achieve the goal for Missouri football that I've had, which is get in the top 25 and never leave. Like, I don't ask for much. I just want them to be in the top 25 and never leave, which they left twice this year. But they got in. So there's that issue there, and I do think that that's something that you should maybe take into account. leading us to, let's just go to this great question that we had here. Let me pull up our heads in a more normal
manner. Great question.
I've been thinking about this the entire show. This is from James. What non-powerhouse programs produce the most pro-ready picks? I mentioned Illinois the other day. Brett Bielema, he does an incredible job of that. Duke would be another example of this. Maybe most is the wrong term, but the guys that you get from Duke, you can trust to at least be competent.
I mean, Iowa's
NFL player.
An option.
Iowa is a very good option. Missouri is not one of those teams. Missouri will give you the talent. They'll give you crazy talent. It is green bananas compared to a lot of other schools. Non-powerhouse programs.
South Carolina is a little too close.
South Carolina is in the same Missouri vein. They really are, where it's green bananas. Let me think about this one for a little bit. Do you want to pull up another question? I'm going to come up with a really good answer.
Yep. Big Tone responding to us talking about Raheem Morris. You'll get arrested for a guy, but not hire him. We'll see. I kind of lean, again, as I said at the start of the show, I'm kind of leaning at this point towards them going with Raheem Morris, but that is all dependent on how the Jim Schwartz stuff goes. I think it might take some time, and I wonder at what point the cutoff is. I think Raheem might still be interviewing for like Arizona.
Yeah, there's still something there. And he might get that job.
Have fun. So I guess it's a nice paycheck.
James, Cal is one of those teams.
Cal's a great answer.
Cal's one of those teams. Justin Wilcox put out ready-made day two, day three defensive backs and defenders. Teddy Buchanan had a nice year, I would argue, for the Ravens. Cal is one of those teams. I will come back with more. You can keep
I'm
going to
be thinking
about
this, too. We'll see. I think really it's going to depend on like how quickly does the Schwartz stuff resolve, because that has to happen in the next week in terms of like, can he get out of the contract? Will they let him out of the contract? Again, horrific ownership and management. So like they might just say he needs some time to cool off. I don't think he's a guy that's going to cool off and say, I'm going to come back. I think he's going to say, you're going to let me out of the contract, or I'm not coaching for the year, and it's up to you how you want to handle this. Or somebody says, hey, let him out of the contract. We'll pay you whatever it was. We'll pay you a fee to let him out of the contract.
Going to give you one more.
Yep.
Toledo.
Ooh, the Zips.
No, Toledo are the Rockets. The Golden Flash. Akron are the Zips.
Wait, who's the Golden Flash? Is that Kent State?
Yeah. Yep. Toledo, Rockets.
I'm sorry, I've been watching a lot of Mac.
Quinyon Mitchell, they got this safety this year. Maybe the Niners should be interviewing their defensive backs coach for some sort of a job, because he can pick them and he can keep them, which is maybe even more impressive. I'm going to come back with more.
I want to keep thinking about this too. There's a lot of good options there, but that's a really good start. Not quite Cincinnati. There's a little bit of a hit or miss, but it's not quite at that level. But I would say, in terms of like an undervalued program that produces some decent players, it's not there, but it is in the mix.
How about Pitt?
Pitt's kind of hit or miss, but like we're on the right track there.
West Virginia does a decent enough job. Guys who come in from West Virginia do a pretty good job. Typically.
In terms of not the high level talent, but like a back end, you're going to get a nice undrafted free agent, Maryland, for like undrafted free agents.
Mike Locke, you know what? That's actually a sneaky good one with Maryland, because Mike Locksley is like an even worse Drinkwitz in that he can recruit him and then he can get him to the floor, but he can never maximize him.
Another one,
Loxley's a good.
Sorry, coach. Another one sort of in that vein, NC State, a little bit.
NC State, that's a tricky one. That's a really tricky one. Defensively, they've been good lately. I can't remember the last good NC State offensive play.
Right. I'm not sure.
But they do. They have a lot of high motor guys at NC State. Though NC State, you could argue, I mean, that's ACC. That's high-end ACC.
Yeah.
This is something that I probably need to fundamentally just have a list of.
I mean, it's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting question.
And it's very difficult in this day and age now, right? Like, what last year I would have said Indiana. Like, it's pretty.
Virginia's pretty not good enough, not consistent enough.
No, they're not consistent enough. You mean ACC title game losers? Duke, I think, is a good floor program. And maybe that's how we need to phrase it. Which guys give you the best floor players that you can, you know, if you're drafting them, you know that they're kind of known entities, known quantities. Yeah.
Wyoming's always got one guy.
They always like have an offensive lineman. God bless them. I was trying to think of, Toledo, I think, is probably the best option. Maybe the problem is Ohio is too on the radar. Ohio and Athens, Ohio, they're too on the radar. They get poached so often that, and so many of these MAC schools, it's just tricky because that's now the Big Ten's starters.
Yeah. They just get moved to a bigger program and then you go, all right, well. Yeah. And anyone that stays at those smaller schools, you go, well, why do they stay at that school? What's their problem?
Yeah. We were asking that with Mitchell 2 years ago, where it's like,
right.
What are you still doing? It's like, oh, loyalty, this and that. And it's like, oh, I don't know. If there was $1 million, I'd have a hard time being loyal.
I'll give you one last one that's not quite the right answer either. But like the Raging Cajuns always have a couple interesting players.
ULL,
I'm not sure that they're always like incredibly pro ready or like incredible. But like for a team down there that's in the Sun Belt, they do some good stuff.
Yeah. I want to say Washington. I feel like Washington's too far ahead. I mean, they played for a national title a couple of years ago, so that doesn't seem fair.
Georgia Tech doesn't really work.
No, Georgia Tech, and I kept coming back to Georgia Tech because I like so much of what they do on a day-to-day basis, but they don't actually put that many pros in the league. Syracuse recently has done a good job.
I was thinking about them. ECU is interesting. East Carolina in terms of like a weird team. That gets
it's a weird
like,
place, by the way. Greensboro, North Carolina, weird spot. Like, it's fun. Like, I like ECU.
Right.
It's a great party school. Like, it's cool, but you're just like, oh, this is not... Because North Carolina is like the Triangle and then, you know, Charlotte, like the Charlotte Metro. And then they're just out there, just hanging. And you're like, whoa, we are 4 hours away from Raleigh. And
not to be confused with the Chanticleers out of Coastal Carolina.
Chanticleers, sorry. Yeah, Coastal Carolina, which is
I think
Myrtle
Cal
Beach.
Right now, though, is probably the answer.
Cal does seem like the answer. And Cal makes some sense in that they're pulling a lot of guys from West Coast community colleges, which are really underrepresented. I'll give you a good one. Kansas State.
That's a good answer.
Because they pull from all of the great, you know, so Texas has really good community college, but it's so over-scouted that you're in community college because you really messed up. Like you did, you like stole the laptops from the school lab one day and now you can't go to, you know, TCU. Kansas community colleges are a great example because while this is getting a lot better, kids from the plains in general just don't get scouted. And it's why South Dakota State, North Dakota State, I would argue even ND and SD are doing a much better job now.
Well, it's hard to see people on the planes because there's nothing in the background. It's just
There's no depth perception. So Kansas State pulls from. I mean, Kansas community college football is up there. It might be the pinnacle of community college football. Like, there's no community college football in Florida, right? In the South, there's just not that much.
Yep.
Whereas in the plains, it exists and it is like kind of a thing. There's a lot of D2 schools there as well. I think that Kansas State is very good at Kansas State and Cal because they do the best job of getting the CC guys to come through and then keeping them because, well, they're CC guys, and by the time they get there, they're already juniors and seniors. So those would be my answers in a very long, winding way to come to it. Let's go with Cal and Kansas State. I feel very good about their coaching situations.
I love it. I love it.
Especially now. I think Tosh is going to do a great job at Cal.
I love that. I think he will do a fantastic job.
Like, I was actually a big Wilcox fan. I thought his defenses were really good, and I thought that Cal fans were getting a little bit too big for their britches. And it's like, you realize that your program was dead, right?
You realize
it was over.
It's crazy, though. Like, they could be a playoff team.
Give him two years.
There's a route.
Give him two years. I mean, but Tosh has done an unbelievable job in getting a lot of guys that he recruited to Oregon and for Oregon. He brought in a hell of a staff. I mean, Oregon's going to have a real hard time.
Recruited pretty well already.
Right. So there was a baseline there. But Tosh coming in, I think keeping Rolovich was a really smart move by them. You know, JKS. Well, they might be in the same category by the end of the year. I mean, if you're a betting person, a little sprinkle
in 2 years for JKS. Whew.
I mean, he looks so good in his freshman year. Like, what happens now? Especially too. I mean, this. Not to get too far down the rabbit hole, but when you watch other quarterbacks in college football, you're like, Jesus Christ, what's going on? What is happening?
Let me just briefly say, if you have not gone into the
$7 million man,
the Iron Curtain, Bryce Underwood for Michigan, fucking terrible. I mean, there's even if you don't want the full episode, you don't want to pay for it. Just a preview clip I have on the Hutch Report.
Yeah.
It's astounding how he doesn't have any concept of what he's looking for. There's basically sort of like a Yankee concept, like, and just the most basic, a deep post and an intermediate over route where you just go high low, one guy takes the safeties with him, and then there's an underneath intermediate route that you throw the ball to.
Easy one to the flat.
That's the read. You throw it over the middle if it's there. His running back gets blown up, but like he immediately stares at it. Like there's no ability to move in the pocket and step up and throw, and he just starts running. I could not believe how bad the film was for him. And if he doesn't improve, Michigan's fucked. Like, I know he should improve. I know he's incredibly, like, he's a five-star. He's number one in the nation. Like, he's a freshman. And Nick Saban was like, he needs a year. He shouldn't be starting. He'll get
better. Well, when you pay him that much.
But, like, the instincts in terms of, like, what he was actually looking at were very, very, very concerning.
We'll find out. But I like JKS better. And, I do too. Boy, can that kid sling it. My goodness gracious.
We were going to keep this thing short. And look at us, an hour and 16 minutes in. 17.
Well, yeah, you can't bring Overcrown into the conversation. Not let us ramble. That's the Senior Bowl. Jake will have takeaways from the actual game. I'm not going to watch it. You couldn't pay me to watch it. You can pay Jake to watch it.
I am being paid to watch it.
I don't even know what next week looks like. I'll be around the Super Bowl. I might try to pull some people. I don't know. I have no idea.
We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll talk draft at some point next week and maybe defensive coordinator, depending on any news.
If you want to see Jake just absolutely lose his shit on an 18-year-old kid, you can subscribe to the Hutch Report. It is it's above him.
You know what? I feel okay about it with NIL now because these kids are getting paid.
Yeah, like, they're getting paid more than us. Yeah,
he's getting properly paid. He's a professional, and that was not professional.
No, and neither was this. We'll talk to you next week.